Polyphonia grew out of Freud's investigation of narcissism. Although it wasn't published until 1917, hence the centenary, it was finished in 1915, almost exactly a year after it completed on narcissism. Freud understands narcissism economically in terms of the distribution of libido between self and object. As such, it's fundamental to understanding self-esteem and self-esteem regulation. These were the years, too, when Freud's thoughts turned to death, not only in Mourning and Melancholia, but in, for example, his beautiful paper on transience. Mourning and Melancholia is concerned not simply with the impact of actual death and loss, but with the loss of some abstraction which has taken the place of death, such as one's country, liberty, an ideal, and so on. And beyond this, in Melancholia in particular, the occasions which give rise to the illness extend beyond loss by death to being slighted, neglected, or disappointed. And that disappointment includes disillusionment with one's own immortality. Or mortality, I mean, in the unconscious, we think we're immortal. Mourning and Melancholia share a profoundly painful dejection, cessation of interest, I'm putting Freud, in the outside world, loss of capacity to love, inhibition of all activity. What distinguishes them is, in Melancholia, a lowering of the self-regarding feelings to a degree that finds utterance in self-reproaches and self-revilings. In Mourning, it is the world that has become poor and empty. In Melancholia, it is the ego itself. If all goes well enough, the mourner over time accepts the painful reality of loss. By contrast, because the melancholic's relation to the lost object has been narcissistic and marked by a conflict due to ambivalence, the love for the object, quoting Freud, takes refuge in narcissistic identification. Then the hate comes into operation on this substitutive object, abusing it, debasing it, making it suffer, and deriving sadistic satisfaction from its suffering. The shadow of the object falls upon the ego, and this is Freud's theory in brief. Negotiating retirement and the loss of an established role at work, in the family, and in society is one of the developmental tasks of advancing years. Another and intertwined task is to acknowledge and accept the aging body and mortality. I'm going to try to say something about failures to mourn, which threaten depression, which centres on the excruciatingly painful gap between reality and an ideal picture of the self that is encapsulated in a role. And I shall be focusing on King Lear, and particularly on W.F. Murnau's silent film from 1924, The Last Laugh. They portray tragedies of retirement when the ego is narcissistically fragile. So narcissistically invested in the role of each is the role of each tragic protagonist that their sense of worth and identity is coterminous with it. Their ontological security depends on it. Confronted with the loss of the equilibrium that their roles have brought them, and confronted too by their inexorable mortality, the tragic protagonists either break with reality to avoid depression and disintegration, or they succumb to it. Reality is too much of an insult. King Lear seeks to find an answer to his loss of role and his mortality through regression to becoming His Majesty the Baby, with his ideal daughter or mother, Cordelia. And he seeks to set his rest on her kind nursery, a timeless, infantile world of omnipotent plenitude where death does not lie in wait. All this is the case because he suffers not simply from the infirmity of his age, but hath ever but slenderly known himself and hoped to return to that. When Cordelia fails to play the part that Lear has scripted for her, she denies him his fantasied nursery world. Instead of being able to crawl in it as the baby in safety, he has to find another solution to the painful reality of, Shakespeare's words, the crawl towards death. he heroically attempts to assert himself as His Majesty the Ego. He clings to his omnipotence with all defensive resources at his disposal in order to stave off recognition of his frailty, rooted in the body, and to avoid fear, depression, madness, and disintegration. He regresses to an infantile mode of functioning. Anybody or anything that contradicts his wishes or sense of himself is alien. He denies their capacity to affect him. Cordelia and Kent assert reality, and Lear cannot bear reality. He banishes them. Like the child, Lear is peremptory. What he says must happen. Nothing is allowed to come between his sentences and his power, which nor his nature nor his place can bear. When Cordelia fails him, he turns to Goneril and Regan, but they humiliate him too. He cannot tolerate his frailty. And with the mounting diffusion of love and aggression, he explodes with narcissistic rage, cursing his daughters with increasing severity, believing in his childlike way that his words will magically inflict the very wounds that they promise. He will make Goneril sterile, or the victim of a thankless child. Or, with the help of fen-sucked frogs, he will blister Regan's beauty. As his narcissistic defences crack, the painful affects he has sought to keep at bay, initiated by the loss of Cordelia, threaten to break through. So we see in King Lear both the precipitating and predisposing factors for depression as described by Freud. Cordelia's disobedience represents a narcissistic object loss. And Lear experiences an unresolved ambivalence towards both her and all she stands for and his own aging body. He has been every inch the king, lived out a role that has carried an ideal image of himself and helped hold him together. Now depression looms. But to acknowledge depression would be a blow to Lear's omnipotence. His defences portend a break with reality. By contrast, his fool experiences grief. Since Cordelia's expulsion, he hath much pined away. In Lear's mind, the fool and Cordelia are ultimately symmetrized. It is through the fool as Lear's shadow that the shadow of Cordelia's loss falls upon Lear. The fool, as a disowned and externalized aspect of Lear himself, takes him to task for his foolishness. The fool represents the melancholic self-criticism that lies in wait for Lear. When the truth that the fool speaks gets too close, Lear threatens to whip him. He begins to acknowledge that reality is not as he wishes it to be, and that there is a gap between his role, or the role he wishes to fulfill, as an all-powerful king and father, and the man he feels himself to be. Hence his cry in the title of this paper, "Does any here know me? Who is it that can tell me who I am?" When Regan humiliates him, he comes close to acknowledging his situation as a poor old man full of grief, as age, wretched in both. But no sooner has he spoken than he vows that he will not weep. He would sooner his heart break into 100,000 flaws and go mad and weep. In order to experience grief, not to experience grief rather, he self-destructively castrates his ego, cuts himself off from frailty, and goes mad. Storm scene brings the break with reality. In his madness, Lear now recognises that the omnipotence he had enjoyed as king, which his court had seemed to confirm, was a lie. When it came to it, the thunder would not peace at his bidding, nor was he ague-proof. Mortality clings to him. He wipes her from his hand before offering it to Gloucester. But his madness also protects him. He believes that the tempest in his own mind makes him immune to the tempest raging outside. He is the storm. Although Lear, a very foolish, fond old man, not in his perfect mind, recognises that Cordelia has cause to punish him, his remorse can be no more than fleeting. When Lear and Cordelia are taken off to prison, Lear envisages prison as a world in which they will sing like birds in the cage. He gathers them lyrically into the artifice of eternity. Once more, Lear conjures up a world redolent of the timeless nursery of... of the timeless nursery of narcissism that he had wished for in retirement. He remains unable to face reality right to the end. He enters with Cordelia dead in his arms, pronouncing her dead as earth. And it seems that he actually acknowledges that this is it. For a moment he seems under no illusion that his poor fool is hanged. And then, in his last breath, he hallucinates life on her lips. Do you see this? Look on her. Look, her lips. Look there. Look there. He dies on a blissful delusion of life together in the nursery of the hereafter. Lear's tragic narcissism has run its full course. Unable to mourn his loss, he's defended himself heroically as His Majesty the Ego with every means at his disposal to maintain the safety of his narcissistic omnipotence. He has tried to direct his diffused aggression at those around him rather than direct it against himself and sink into melancholia. Stripped of his role and made aware of his mortality, assailed by shame and guilt, he has retreated into madness. His last-ditch defense is topographical regression. Now, in a metapsychological supplement to the theory of dreams, which was written at the same time as Mourning and Melancholia, this very fertile period, Freud wrote of a form of a hallucinatory wishful psychosis, which stems from, I quote, a reaction to loss which reality affirms, but which the ego has to deny, since it finds it insupportable. Thereupon, writes Freud, the ego breaks off its relation to reality. Reality testing is got rid of. The wishful fantasies are able to press forward into the system conscious, and they are regarded as a better reality. Lear's ultimate act of self-destructiveness is madness. Even though it doesn't allow him to die blissfully, die blissfully in paradise in Cordelia's arms, we, the audience, know by tragic irony that he dies self-deluded. King Lear's tortured failure to mourn is deepened by his also finding it too painful to suffer depression. King Lear is Shakespeare's tragedy of old age and narcissism. I turn to The Last Laugh, Murnau's Last Laugh, which you might not know so well as Lear. Murnau's protagonist is no king, but an unnamed doorman at the Atlantic Hotel in Berlin. He suffers a depression that is, in essence, the disintegration in the face of having to experience the gulf between reality and a role that has provided a carapace to protect a very vulnerable, barely formed self. He too scarcely knows himself. I'll show this disintegration in action. The first time we see the doorman, he's outside the hotel, in pouring rain, his uniform covered by a black waterproof cape and hood. Lots of people are arriving and their luggage must be carried inside. Throughout the film, there is a strong sense of hierarchy amongst the hotel workers, marked by difference in their uniforms, or the absence of uniform. And the doorman, whose uniform looks like that of a military general in the Weimar Republic, expects that others will do the carrying as he escorts guests inside beneath his umbrella. But there is one trunk he cannot get anyone to carry. The doorman has to take it down himself from the luggage rack on the top of the taxi and carry it inside. In age, his strength is waning, and he does so with difficulty, only just managing. And once inside, he slumps on a chair in a heap, physically and psychologically done for. The page boy brings him a reviving drink, and all this is observed by the hotel manager, who will later summon him to his office to demote him, ultimately to lavatory attendant. The doorman's uniform clothes him in a grandiose self. So long as he can exhibit himself in it, his carapace self can remain intact. In this clip, we see him return to his station outside the hotel. The rain has abated, so that he can take fresh strength from his uniform. According to what Ferenczi called the omnipotence by the help of magic gestures. He's only to doff his waterproof, and there is someone to take it. An umbrella appears. This is why he is so dejected when, despite his gestures becoming more and more urgent, there is no one to take the trunk. In his uniform, he is His Majesty the doorman, both at the hotel and at the tenement where he lives. If his uniform confers on him grandiose authority, it also confers on him sexual potency as a man attractive to women, even young women. In reality, however, the grandiosity is factitious, and the uniform has the status of a fetish. His uniform is a fragile, narcissistic carapace within which he is actually empty of himself. And without it, he collapses into internal nothingness. That he is unnamed underlines his fragility. He is the doorman, and no more. Mono and his scriptwriter Carl Mayer are remarkably intuitive about the workings of the unconscious, psychic development, and the inner world. The film is structured around, as you notice, motifs and symbols that carry the theme of psychic fragility in the face of old age. Uniform is one, cabin trunks and laughter others. There's also the mirror. The doorman invests narcissistic in his uniform as representing his grandiose self, and when it is reflected back to him, it is all he sees. To be separated from it spells disintegration. Whereas in Winnicott's terms, the mirror mother helps the infant to recognize himself as having subjective value, a function internalized if all goes well enough, to form the basis of creative subjectivity and self-esteem. The mirror that the doorman pulls out from beneath his uniform is one that he uses to keep up the grandiose self-image threatened by age. What is so interesting here is how the mirror is produced from the back pocket of his trousers beneath his uniform. Janine Chatzkiss-Mergel's exploration of falsehood describes a particular developmental arrest that informs the character of those men who, like the doorman, are fakes. They have been unable to project their ideal self onto their father and his penis, and to identify with him as part of Oedipal development, leaving them having to find other means of closing the gap between their self and their ideal self to grant themselves identity. They fake masculinity, and their falsehood is built on the equation feces equals penis, so that when they pass what they pass off as phallic to provide narcissistic achievement, grandiose masculinity in the case of the doorman, is only an anal phallus. The film charts the doorman's collapse. Called to the manager's office, he is told that he will replace another long-term member of staff, a laboratory attendant, who has been found a place in a home in recognition of his loyalty to the hotel. His demotion is poignantly appropriate for him as a fake. The doorman is on a path through aging to redundancy, dependency in a home, and death. He remonstrates, but fails to reverse the manager's decision. The manager, sitting at his desk, waves him away and turns his back, and the doorman sees a trunk against the wall, picks it up to reassert his strength and fitness for the post he has lost. He cannot accept the diminution of his powers, nor can he balance the trunk above his head, and he drops it. Outside the hotel, we see the new doorman lifting luggage with ease. Although it seems clear that lifting the trunk is a botched exhibition of undiminished strength, the episode is also an expression of unconscious narcissistic rage, a desperate attempt to blot out profound narcissistic injury by destroying its source. Had the doorman staggered further towards his manager and dropped the trunk, he might have inflicted severe injury. His failure leaves him stupefied. The manager orders his uniform to be stripped from him as if being cashiered in a shameful military ceremony. I'll show a bit of this. This is a scene of utter degradation. Momentarily alone, unable to tolerate his separation from his omnipotent self embodied in his uniform, he feels impelled to reunite himself with it and to make one his self and his ideal self-image. The uniform is locked away, but he secretes a key to retrieve it. He is consigned to the lavatory, a white jacket in place of his uniform. Now, all this happens on the day when there are wedding celebrations back in the tenement where his niece is getting married. He must make off with his old uniform so that he can return to take part in them without loss of face. And although he acts stealthily in the film, the suggestion is that this isn't so much because he feels that he's doing something wrong, but more because he's in the throes of narcissistic compulsion to avoid shame and humiliation. Once he's back in his uniform, he occupies a delusion that he is the doorman he has always been. At the party he gets drunk, enjoys the company of a woman, and is still drunk in the morning when he sets off for work. He's still in denial about his demotion, in a delusional bubble that he is still the doorman, stumbling back to take up his old position. This is the stuff of dreams. He's in a state of hallucinatory wishful psychosis. Indeed, before he set out from the tenement, he enjoyed a dream that he could lift a huge trunk with one hand and then juggle it. I didn't have time to show the dream, unfortunately. It's a beautiful bit of film. Of course, the dream is fueled by drink to some extent, but it's also consistent with his desperate narcissistic defences. Reality is dissolved in alcohol and hallucination. When he nears the hotel, he sees the new and younger doorman at work. He cannot believe his eyes. He cannot believe his eyes. And then he tries to deny what he sees. As reality closes on him, he leaves his uniform at the station in left luggage and hurries to the hotel to take up his post in the basement lavatories. As if this weren't enough, the woman he spent the night drinking with seeks him out of the hotel and discovers that he is not the doorman anymore. She runs back home, she spreads the word, so that by the time he returns to the tenement, dressed once again falsely in his stolen uniform, the whole tenement block ridicules him and casts him out. He is now homeless, as well as rollerless and without identity. Broken and depressed, he returns to the hotel, finds the night watchman, returns the uniform, and takes refuge in the lavatory. The night watchman covers him as he might a child with his coat. Let's play the full clip of this, I hope. Thank you. portrays depressive emptiness at its extreme. The doorman is nothing. He knows only shame. But Buller adds a twist, a final denial of reality, akin to Lear's delusion. Here, at this place of humiliation, the old man would waste away miserably, and theoretically, the story would be over. But the author is looking after how the one who has been abandoned by everybody, and he gives him an epilogue, telling a story that usually doesn't occur in real life, unfortunately. Sensational inheritance. It is said that Murnau's studio demanded a happy ending. Whether that's the case or not, he and Meyer produced a dreamlike coda, a dream of classic wish fulfillment, dreamed by the doorman, as is in the lavatory, to escape from reality in the narcissistic state of sleep. As such, it echoes early narcissistic defences, including his drunken dream of juggling the trunk. In the dream, a Mexican multimillionaire has bequeathed his fortune to the person in whose arms he died. That person, in turn, it turns out it was the doorman as lavatory attendant. And in his dream, he celebrates his newfound fortune with the last person he saw, very acute about dreams, before he fell asleep, the night watchman. They feast, and they carouse in style at the Atlantic, much to the annoyance of the manager. They skip a little. And his uniform, let's say, his uniform now is an expensive suit and a monocle that confers on him, at least from the outside, the potent masculinity of wealth, nullifying the gulf between himself and his ideal self-image. Sometimes a cigar is not just a cigar. It's a fecal phallus. A fake anal phallus. One of my patients said at her first meeting, that her problem was that she didn't have a well inside. She meant, we came to understand, that she didn't have a sense of well-being, like a well, which she could dip into to draw up a life-giving water of self-esteem. Another patient recently told me that he lived on the edge of a sinkhole within him, in danger of plummeting into it. The well and the sinkhole sum up experiences of creative and empty narcissism, which have their early formation in relation to the environment. In old age, it matters enormously whether someone has a well or a sinkhole within. A substantial sense of a vital self, or at least the seeds of one, or a carapace self. Where a sinkhole has developed, as it had with both King Lear and the doorman, I think, it is unlikely that depression can have value in Winnicott's terms without considerable psychotic developmental help. It is necessary for survival to use relationships with people, one's role at work, in society, and in the family as a patch to maintain a carapace self. These are the people who scarcely know themselves because there is scarcely a self to know. This patch may have provided protection from underlying emptiness, but in retirement it may disappear or feel threatened. And then we see either profound depressive collapse into an inner black hole or desperate defences against that happening. Thank you.